This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Another Monday, another rescue. The fast-moving financial crisis that hit Citigroup hard a year ago nearly swamped it last week. But over the weekend, President Bush and his advisors decided to inject another $20 billion into one of the world's biggest banks, money that he said today was necessary to safeguard the financial system. The president also said that he spoke with the next president about his decision.
I told the American people, and I told the president-elect when I first met him, that any time we were to make a big decision during this transition, he will be informed, as will his team. Secretary Paulson is working closely with the President-elect's transition team. It's important for the American people to know that there is close cooperation.
Earlier this afternoon, President-elect Obama held a news conference in Chicago to announce some key economic appointments and talked about Citigroup, his aggressive new financial rescue plan, significantly more aggressive than the one he campaigned on, and tax plans that may also differ from those he emphasized before the election. Later in the hour, more than 100 retired military leaders issued a statement calling for the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. On the opinion page this week, we'll talk with one retired admiral about why he changed his mind. But first, the scrambled mess of economic news has real consequences for you, the consumer, so we know you've got questions. What do you want to know about President-elect Obama's economic recovery team, the plan he's assembled to execute it, and the Citigroup rescue, the snub to the auto industry? Our phone number, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. And you can join the conversation on our website. Go to npr.org and click on Talk of the Nation. We begin with Peter Wallison, a Treasury General Counsel in the 1980s and now a fellow at the American Enterprise Institute in Washington, D.C. He joins us from our bureau in New York. Nice to have you on the program today.
Good to be here. Thank you.
And as you look at the team that President-elect Obama announced today, is this a team that's going to be able to work with both liberals and conservatives, Democrats and Republicans? Are they the best and the brightest that President-elect Obama was talking about?
Well, you never know who's the best and the brightest. The brightest are easy to measure. The best is much more difficult to measure. But I'm quite happy myself with this team. I think Larry Summers and Tim Geithner in particular, who I know, are solid economists and well acquainted with the market. And I think among all of the people that President-elect Obama could have chosen, these are the two best.
Larry Summers, of course, the former Secretary of the Treasury, announced today as the Director of the National Economic Council. Tim Geithner, who used to work for him at the Treasury Department, now going to be the next Secretary of the Treasury. I wanted to ask you also, the President-elect said today when he was asked about the stimulus package, he declined to give specifics on the numbers involved. Some of his advisors have said something in the range of $700 billion to more than that. But in any case, he was saying that there is consensus that a big jolt to the economy is necessary and that left and right, everybody agrees that a big stimulus package is required. Do you agree?
Oh, yes, I certainly agree. I don't agree with probably the dimensions that the direction that the stimulus package will take, because my own view is that a very large tax cut would be the most effective way to get money into people's hands quickly. I'm afraid that a lot of what the Obama stimulus package will consist of is payments to states, perhaps, and perhaps infrastructure projects, which take an awfully long time to get into the economy. We need an immediate jolt, and for that reason, a true tax cut, not just the tax credits that Obama has been talking about, but a true cut in everyone's income taxes would be the best jolt for the economy.
Let's bring another voice into the conversation. Sebastian Mallaby is here with us in Studio 3A. He's a columnist of the Washington Post, director of the Center for Geoeconomic Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. Good of you to be with us today.
Good to be here.
And as you look at the infrastructure spending that has been at least proposed and talked about, as opposed to tax cuts, as we just heard from Peter Wallison, how do you come down on this?
Well, Peter Wallison is quite right that it takes a while for this infrastructure expenditure to feed into the economy. If, you know, President-elect Obama is saying just now, you know, we're in a negative downward spiral, and the earliest that we can possibly imagine passing this stimulus is not until January, and then it takes a while for government agencies to pump that money out. There's a big lag there. I also think, though, that there's a similar question you can raise about tax cuts. With tax cuts, You give people the money, it takes a while to for that tax cut to take effect. And when it gets to people, they may spend it or they may save it. You can't control that. So I think you have to sort of try both. You have to hope that either of them work to some extent. And in the meantime, I think you do have to go to the Federal Reserve and quietly, you know, let them know that if they choose to do something quite radical in terms of essentially printing money to get more money out into the economy, they will have the approval and sort of support of the incoming team at the Treasury, because it's monetary policy that can most quickly change the dynamic in the markets.
This is a political and psychological moment as well as an economic one. Of course, those things play into everything. And President-elect Obama appeared to be anxious to continue to spread the sort of calm, the oil on the waters that he displayed during his campaign, to say, without saying quite so much, if there might be some criticism of the man who's in office now as not being active enough, I am engaged. The work begins today.
That's right. I mean, there was a terribly debilitating sense leading up to the end of next week of a sort of leadership vacuum from Washington. On the one hand, the Treasury had promised an enormous bank bailout plan, which was supposed to be targeted at banks' bad debts. Then the plan changed, and it was going to be about injecting equity into banks. Now it's changing again with the Citigroup bailout back toward the government helping to deal with bad debt. So you've got all this chopping and changing, which is simply terrible for confidence, because the markets know that the economy, left to its own devices, is going to spiral downwards, and it's only going to be government action at this point that breaks the fall. And so when you seem to have a leadership vacuum from Washington, it's disastrous. That's why just the mere leaking of the news that Tim Geithner would be nominated as Treasury Secretary on Friday afternoon sent the market up on a very big rally. The market rally has continued so far today. And so you're right. I mean, it's a psychological moment. And by stepping forward, holding the press conference, I think President-elect Obama is helping.
Let's see if we can get some listeners in on this conversation. 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. And why don't we begin with Ginny? And Ginny's with us in Ann Arbor, Michigan.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I sort of had a two-part question, and I'll get to it real quickly and take my answer off the air. My question to your panel is, why do these bank bailouts always seem to occur on a late night, Saturday and Sunday, and we all wake up on Monday to find out about it? And how come they aren't in front of a congressional panel like the big three is, you know, having everybody wag their finger about the corporate jets and no plan, et cetera? And I'll take my answer off the air.
All right, Ginny, thanks very much for the phone call. And I think we can answer the first part of your question, Sebastian Malaby, by suggesting that the markets are closed over the weekend, and that's why these plans are leaked over the weekend.
That's right. I mean, it takes a while to work them out. And so typically, you know, the market goes crazy during the week. The negotiations start during the week, but they get to a head and they get to a conclusion and yield a result on Sunday night. In Citigroup's case, it was rather late on Sunday night. You know, but the caller raises a very reasonable question, which is, you know, when Detroit comes to Washington, there's all this complaint about what kind of jet they showed up into the hearing, and they're told to go away and think again and take some time, and we're not in a hurry. When it's Wall Street, the government is in a hurry. I'm afraid there's actually a good reason for that, which is that financial panics can destroy banks extremely quickly, and that can have knock-on effects to other banks just as quickly, and then that ripples out into the entire economy. The reason why Detroit, the three car companies, are in such a problem now is that financing to buy a vehicle, auto loans, simply dried up. And if you look at a chart of the way that auto loans dried up, you see the fortunes of the car companies kind of crash after that. And so this is just one example of the way that the government really has to respond super quick to banking crises in a way that it has, you know, it has few more weeks and margin with car companies, which is why you get this apparent double standard in the way they're treated.
But Peter Wallison, the double standard is exactly the point. A lot of fingers shaken at Detroit and tisk tisk and boo boo. And nevertheless, everybody agrees that Citigroup made a lot of mistakes too. Nevertheless, they're getting a lot of money.
Yes, well, of course, as Sebastian Malaby suggests, banks are central to the continued operation of our economy, and the automobile companies, as important as they are only, in effect, recipients of bank lending. So we have to get the banks lending. We have to keep the banks in a strong position in order to support every industry that is operating, not just not just auto companies. I would add, too, that Sunday nights are important because you have to get many of these things done before the Asian markets open. A lot of this has to do with the confidence of investors, and the rallies or falls in the Asian markets affect the European markets, which open next, and then those affect the way the U.S. markets operate. So Sundays turn out to be a pretty important day.
Now let's get Cynthia on the line. Cynthia with us from Vernon in New York.
Hello, Neil and guests. I would like to make this comment and have a question. Obama told us that if we voted for McCain, we'd have four more years of Bush policies. But he never said that if he was elected, he would have four more years of Clinton policies. And Clinton's administration, in my view, was just as responsible for the tragedy of the war and the sanctions and the bombing of Iraq and getting free trade NAFTA through instead of fair trade. So I would just like to say one more thing from the provinces. That people who make $100,000 or more, they talk about a recession. We, the peasants in the provinces, we know now that it is a depression. And also the last thing, I know why the fellow from the American Enterprise System says what he says, because that's a very conservative think tank. I don't know about the other one. So are there two different views represented by your guests? And I'll listen now.
Okay, Cynthia, okay. Very nice of you to talk. And to her first point, Sebastian Mallaby does represent a different point of view from Peter Wallace, and I can assure you of that. But we just have a few seconds left in this segment. But certainly Clinton personnel are in charge of economic policy, and Larry Summers associated with deregulation, with free trade, and with budget discipline. And nevertheless, those are not going to be the policies that President Obama necessarily pursues. We'll talk more about that when we get back from a break. Our guests are Sebastian Mallaby of the Washington Post and the Council on Foreign Relations and Peter Wallison of the American Enterprise Institute. I'm Neil Conan. Stay with us. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. The theme today for President-elect Barack Obama was urgency. At his news conference a couple of hours ago, he said, "We do not have a minute to waste." He pushed the new Congress to move quickly to pass a stimulus package in January, though he declined to be drawn on how large that package should be. He warned the economy is likely to get worse before it gets better. We're talking with Sebastian Mallaby this hour about what Mr. Obama's plan means for the economy and for you. He's a columnist at the Washington Post and director at the Center for Geoeconomic Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. Also with us is Peter Wallison, former general counsel at the U.S. Treasury Department and the Arthur Burns Fellow in Financial Policy Studies at the American Enterprise Institute. What do you want to know about the Obama Economic Recovery Plan or the team that he's assembled to execute it? 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. The president-elect laid out an aggressive strategy to try to help the besieged economy, but he also had some strong words for at least one struggling sector.
We can't just write a blank check to the auto industry. Taxpayers can't be expected to pony up more money for an auto industry that has been resistant to change. And I was surprised that they did not have a better thought out proposal when they arrived in Congress. I think Congress did the right thing, which is to say, you guys need to come up with a plan and come back before you're getting any taxpayer money.
And let's get another caller on the line, and this is Sterling. Sterling with us from Aiken in South Carolina.
Yes, Neil, can I get a comment from your panel there? I think if the big three did have to claim bankruptcy and reorganize because what they're doing certainly is not working, wouldn't that give the financing a chance to catch up?
Sebastian Mallaby, what do you think?
Well, when the caller says the financing a chance to catch up, I guess he means that the reorganization would give the car companies a chance to survive. I mean, that depends on whether the reorganization is good enough that it really puts them on a sound footing. I would say that, there's two things to be said about what Obama said just now. The first is that substantively he's correct. The car companies did come to Washington without a clear plan about how they were going to reorganize. And so it's correct to say to them, you know, don't expect money until you do better than that. But politically, I think it's very important also that if Obama is calling for an unprecedented, enormous stimulus package, he's going to throw masses of money at the economy to try and turn it around. He needs to get Congress behind him, and that includes Republicans in the Senate, who do remain powerful enough to veto things. And I think he therefore needs to show that his credentials are not merely that he's coming at this from a sort of liberal, spend money in all directions kind of point of view. He can be tough when it's merited, but he does want to spend money when the economy is in a downward spiral and he wants to get out of that. So I think it's politically important as well as substantively correct.
Peter Wallison, should the big three automakers in Detroit be allowed to go and do bankruptcy?
Well, it depends on what bankruptcy really means. You can go into reorganization under the supervision of a bankruptcy trustee, and you are not actually required at that point to stop your business. The auto companies say that this would be not possible for them because people would not buy cars under those circumstances. But I think the financing arrangements and the warranty arrangements and things like that can be substituted if necessary, and I don't think it necessarily means that the automobile companies will not be able to sell their cars. I think one of the best things that can be done for the auto industry is to put it under some sort of prepackaged reorganization structure, which can be done under the bankruptcy laws. Let them terminate a lot of the contracts that are very unfavorable, reform their pension arrangements, reform their health services arrangements, and put them back on a sound footing. Right now, they just cannot compete.
Wait a minute. You say reform their pension and reform their health care. In other words, the people who signed contracts years ago expecting their pension plans and their health coverage to be continued, they're not going to get what they signed up for?
That's one of the problems that the automobile companies have, and that is that they are burdened with a much older workforce and health care requirements that their competition does not have. So these things have to be looked at again. If we want to have a healthy and competitive auto industry, those contracts are going to have to be looked at and reformed in some way.
But you're going to bankrupt an awful lot of people as opposed to bankrupting a car company.
That's not necessarily the case.
There's a government backstop which is worth recalling. I mean, the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation is there. It's a federal entity. And it will ensure that retirees get at least part of the pension promise, not 100%, but part of it. And on the medical side, there is Medicare. So it's tough. People did sign contracts. They did work on the basis that they were going to get a certain kind of benefit. And that promise will be partially broken. Just as the promise to creditors who loaned money, thinking they would get all the money back, that must be broken too. Some of the debts won't be repaid. But I think Peter Wallison is right that the restructuring has to include some of these promises to retirees.
Thanks, Alan Sterling, for the call. Let's go next to James. James on the line with us from Charlotte, North Carolina.
Hi, Neil. Thanks for taking my call.
Go ahead, please.
I had a comment. I just went to the mailbox before I climbed in the car and turned on your show, and I had a letter from Citibank raising the interest rates and the minimum interest rate on my credit card from 12.99% to 18.99%. And I'm sure this is a mass mailing to everyone. Now, we don't have a balance. We haven't had one in many years, but I'm just thinking that the United States population has just loaned them $45 billion, and in return we get a raising of minimum interest rates for all those people. Everyone I know has a credit card balance. And so, you know, we're supposed to get an injection of cash, but at what price? They're supposed to make credit available, and maybe they are, but at what price? And those who have no other options, this is a tax on them. They're going to have fewer cash to spend on other things. So it's just a comment. Any comments your panelists would have would be most appreciated.
Yeah, I mean, the caller is exactly right, that this is precisely how trouble at the banks, on the one hand, feeds directly into the lives of every American. And that's why Obama was right today to say, look, Main Street and Wall Street have their fortunes in the same basket. You can't have trouble in the financial sector without it being trouble for everybody. Now, you know, is it unfair that Citigroup gets money from the government and yet it still raises interest rates for credit card holders? You know, in some sense it may be, but the thing is that, you know, the credit card holders would be even worse off if Citigroup went under. And the best hope we have is to stabilize these financial companies with government assistance, and then in time they will resume the provision of loans and credit card loans included to everybody else. And I'm afraid there's no other way around it.
And Peter Wallison, I want to hear you on that, but in the context of this email from Heather in Minneapolis, if Citibank is too big to fail, is there any stipulation in this bailout for it to be cut into smaller pieces, a la Ma Bell? Isn't this a sign that we can't afford these huge multinational conglomerates?
Well, I don't think that is a good policy. I think we do need large financing institutions like Citibank when we are dealing in a globalized world. Our companies that operate globally need financing globally. So we shouldn't really be thinking that bigness per se is the reason for our problems. If we cut all these banks down to smaller size and they had made the same terrible investments that Citi and the rest of them made all over the world, we would just have many, many more banks in trouble. So it's not bigness that has caused the problem. We ought to be focusing on making sure that in the future banks function properly and we have the proper policies in place to keep them from taking excessive risks. On the question of the credit cards, that is a very difficult question. I agree with Sebastian Malaby on that. This is a very complex question, and if the banks were not to recover as much as they need in order to survive from their credit card and other activities, we would have to feed more money into them. So it's a question of balancing the interests of taxpayers on the one hand, balancing the interests of our economy, and also balancing the interests of people who have credit cards. When the banks recover, and they are able to adjust more fully their credit card debt, their credit card interest rates against the risks that they are taking, it's likely that those rates will be reduced. But right now, they have to recover whatever they can in order to continue functioning.
James, good luck. Thanks very much for the phone call. I think he's left us and listened to the answer off the air. Let's go on to the question of tax cuts. And, let's go to Rita. Rita's with us from Newbury in Ohio.
Hi. I'm an old realtor, and I have a suggestion and a question. Don't you think it would be wise if we stopped banks from selling their mortgages? It seems to me that that's the nub of the problem. If they continue to do that, we'll continue to have foreclosures because they treat their mortgages like a hot potato. Because they know that the people are not qualified to pay them.
Sebastian Malaby, should banks be required to hold on to the mortgages they lend out, at least for a period of time?
That's actually a very interesting debate. I mean, on the one hand, people thought before that if the banks made a loan for a mortgage and then sold bits of it in securities to lots of other people, the risk would be spread out around the system, and so we'd have less risk because each holder of the security could afford to take the hit. What we discovered is that there's so much of this securitized mortgage debt that, in fact, people couldn't afford to take the hit. And it was spread from one bank to another bank, and Bank A gave it to Bank B, B gave it to A, and in the end, it wasn't really distributed very well. And so, yes, I think the conventional wisdom or the sort of, leading edge of this debate is pointing towards some effort to force the banks that originate the mortgage loans to keep some of that risk on their own balance sheets, not just set it out the back door, because then they have an incentive to monitor the loans and make sure that the quality of the lending is better next time around.
Yeah, it's important, though, to keep in mind, if I may add, that if the banks can't sell their loans, they don't get the cash back to make further mortgage loans. And if we require them to hold on to the loans that they make, then we will reduce the actual amount of lending that is possible for homes. So we have to balance those two issues. But it is certainly true, as Sebastian Malaby suggests, that the banks should probably be required to hold on to at least a portion of the risk so that they are attentive to the question of underwriting, which is very important and has been ignored in the past.
Rita, thanks for the suggestion.
Okay.
Bye-bye. Let's go now to Dana. Dana with us from Wauseon in Ohio.
I've got a two-part question with regards to taxes. Are you still there?
Yep, we're here.
Okay. The one is I think the capital gains tax encouraged the housing the problem. But secondly, what about implementing Obama's plan to let the Bush tax cuts run their course and then give the tax cut to the run-of-the-mill guy out here in the small town and in the working class communities throughout the country.
If memory serves, Dana, I think President then-Senator Obama campaigned on the idea of repealing President Bush's tax cuts, and today he talked about whether they might be repealed or allowed to expire naturally. In other words, continue, I think, until 2011 when the law requires them to expire.
Then I would say that we need them faster than that, so they do need to be repealed.
And Peter Wallison, he talked about the disproportionate benefit in those tax cuts for the wealthier people, and that given the economic crisis, those who have more ought to be asked to pay a little bit more.
Yes, but on the other hand, the people who would be taxed in that situation are many of the people, especially in the small business world, who are employing a lot of people. And what we want to do is keep people employed. The more we tax people, especially in a weak economy, the less likely we are to have solid employment, or at least the unemployment problem, which is likely to get worse over the next 2 years, will get significantly worse if people who are in the upper 5% of all taxpayers are required to pay more.
And Sebastian Mallaby, that may be a valid economic point, but the issue of fairness that I think Dana is raising here is uppermost in a lot of people's minds.
That's right. I mean, I think in this environment where, you know, Peter Wallison and I have both been defending the idea of giving lots of money to Wall Street and saying that, you know, car companies are kind of in a different category, and there is a question of equity. I mean, you know, the average homeowner who's falling behind on mortgage payments, you know, is in a very tough spot. So far, the federal assistance for that kind of person is very limited. There may be more to come, but basically the lion's share of this bailout money so far is going to Wall Street, and there is something fundamentally troubling about that. And so in my view, you do have to bring in this political consideration of what's going to pass, you know, which what's going to make it possible to put through this program without having a political backlash, and maybe tax hikes for the wealthy is a legitimate part of that.
Dana, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
We're talking with Peter Wallison of the American Enterprise Institute and Sebastian Mallaby of the Washington Post, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Art's on the line. Art with us from Cleveland.
Hi. I haven't heard anyone explain yet exactly how a bailout works. So for a bank or financial service company getting money, does the money go right to their balance sheet? Are there any restrictions on how they can use it? And do they have to repay all or a portion of it?
Peter Wallison, you used to work in the Treasury Department.
Well, we didn't do bailouts at that time. But the way these bailouts, if they are bailouts, are working, there are a variety of ways. One of them is to add capital to the banks, which is simply cash that is given in return for a security of some kind, usually a preferred, non-voting preferred stock. Another way is what Treasury did and the rest of the government did with Citibank today, and that is to guarantee a portion of their assets so that if those assets further decline in value, that will not further weaken the institution, and also provide some additional capital to those institutions. So both of those things assist in keeping their balance sheet strong, and that addresses the central problem that everyone in the banking industry has been facing because of doubts about the quality of their assets, and that is that we are putting some kind of floor under the assets, giving people confidence to continue to trade with these institutions, lend money to them, deposit funds with them, and allow them, if they themselves feel that they have enough capital to continue operating, to start making some loans. But it will take some time.
And Sebastian Mallaby, Art, thanks very much for the call. It's a good question. Let me ask you, President Bush said today, look, there may have to be other of these actions before he leaves office. Is there really a floor? Has something been established? And is this interregnum period contributing to the problems at this point?
You know, the problem that you see with the Citigroup bailout is that it is a one-institution bailout. It's designed for just one bank. And when we had earlier on the rescue of AIG, that's when the Treasury said, look, we can't just go from institution to institution doing it in an ad hoc fashion. We need something more systematic. And that's where they came up with this TARP, $700 billion authorized by Congress, to try and stabilize the whole system in a more kind of methodical manner. Well, now we've had some of that TARP spending. It didn't prevent Citi from getting into terrible trouble. So we're back to the ad hoc methodology, which we'd already admitted is a mistake. So yes, there's a high degree of danger that other institutions will go the same way as Citi because they are no more protected than Citi was before the weekend.
Sebastian Mallaby, thanks very much for your time today. We appreciate it.
Good to be with you.
Sebastian Malaby, the columnist for the Washington Post, director of the Center for Geoeconomic Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations, joined us here in Studio 3A. Peter Wallison, thank you for your time today.
Thank you.
Peter Wallison, the former general counsel at the U.S. Treasury Department in the 1980s, now the Arthur F. Burns Fellow in Financial Policy Studies at the American Enterprise Institute, with us from our bureau in New York. Up next, a group of retired military leaders argue it's time to get rid of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. We'll talk with one of them about why he changed his mind on the opinion page. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.